Welcome to Cartoonist Kayfabe. My name's Ed Piskor.
I'm Jim Rugg.
Jim, why don't we talk about one of the first manga to come to America? I Saw It by Keiji Nakazawa. But first, what do you have for us, man?
Street Angel, Deadliest Girl Alive. This is the Image Comics collection, available wherever comics and books are sold and bought. You can find this. You can order it. You can get it from your comic shop. If you have a good comic shop, you can get it online. And you can see how I made this book on my Patreon, patreon.com/JimRugg. I post original art. I post page analysis, like page by page, how I made this book. You can see the entire process, including scripts, thumbnails, roughs, layouts, all of that good stuff. If you're into what we do here on Cartoonist Kayfabe, you'll find a lot more of that focused on my own comics making at patreon.com/JimRugg.
Barefoot Jen, good, noble use of the comics medium, but allow me to indulge in my own vulgarity for 10 seconds, man. Red Room Comics, Murder on the Dark Web for Fun and Profit. Next issue comes out mid-September, as of this recording, 2021. Murder on the Dark Web for Fun and Profit, Jim, every issue completely self-contained. So you see an issue in the wild, you scoop it up, you read it, you're going to get a complete experience. If you like that experience, read another issue. It builds on to the kind of world that I'm designing. You're going to get a clear picture of a universe where this stuff is going down. There's going to be a trade paperback coming out in early November. And if you want to check these comics out ahead of time, you don't have a good comic shop in your neighborhood, go to the Fantagraphics website, order the comics directly through them, or go to my Patreon, patreon.com/EdPiskor. $3 for the archive there. I'm serializing strips every Tuesday. Got over 150 pages worth of stuff up there right now for $3. We're into the sixth or seventh issue at this point. The Rat Queens issue is being disseminated to the world, man. Hit my link tree up in the description below this video to get to those destinations. I Saw It, The Atomic Bombing of Hiroshima, survivor story by Keiji Nakazawa. Jim, this is one of the first manga to be translated into English. He holds the distinction of being probably the first five manga that were translated into English, with Gen or Gen of Hiroshima being the first efforts. We read in the Frederick Schott book, Manga Manga, where he was sort of just mentioning the obstacles to get a comic translated into English. Now you gotta white out a bunch of stuff, you gotta get good copies of the material. You have a bunch of Shonen Jumps, I have a bunch of Shonen Jumps. That printing ain't all that great, man. Like, where you gonna get that good imagery from? Now you gotta flip stuff. And if the cartoonist is very particular, like a Goseki Kojima or Katsuhiro Otomo, now you gotta reorient the suits, you know, that these guys are wearing, because you know, they close one way, or swords are supposed to be held in the right hand. There's a lot of toil that goes into producing these comics for the American market in order to keep things true. And sometimes the flip isn't even done on the whole page. Sometimes the panels are cut up and just put in a different order, with the characters, with the artwork still in the same orientation as the Japanese. Like, there's a lot of work.
Yeah, this is a translation. Hard to even fathom, like, the initial foray of bringing manga here, trying to figure out a way to make it palatable and readable for an English audience. There's a note in the back, you know, where you're showing, like, sort of the other publications that were around this one, of donations to speed the translation and publication and distribution of future volumes. And it says it's an all-volunteer, not-for-profit organization. So kind of an interesting from a lot of angles, this book. You know, it is such a historical, important piece for American comics and American comics market. But amazing that we have as much information about this and Frederick Schott, you know, one of the key contributors, as we do. Pretty great.
This imagery here from the very first volume, I saw that in elementary school. There were posters or something. I'm not sure how this was on my radar. Maybe from an anime, and maybe there was a poster in my, like, local mom and pop movie video store. But this imagery is iconic to me, and I've seen it kind of my entire life. But I'm not exactly sure how it was kind of, like, on my radar that early. Very smart to choose something of this kind of historic significance, something educational.
I was gonna say, like, that's, I think, how you would find images like that, is because my copy of Barefoot Gen Volume 1 it's, my wife had it, I think, from a class she took. You know, I think it was required reading. So, you know, it's a different channel than we're used to, going through like education and nonprofit to publish something like this. But it does have the benefit of getting in front of maybe a different audience, maybe having a long life. You know, you start putting it in schools and now you're teaching it. So then you're bringing up this new generation of readers. We were talking off camera and it's like, I read this and my first thought is Scott McCloud. You know, you think of like a comic scholar getting hold of this early on and really being blown away by it. Rereading it this week, I was super impressed by it. And that's what, 40 years later, after the English publication, I think 1982 publication date for this. So we're almost 40 years later, and it's still kind of an amazing volume. You know, like, I love digging through these back issue bins and dollar bins and quarter bins. I'm sure that's where I found this. And this is what I'm looking for. You know, this is a gem whenever you're going through those things. I didn't know what this was when I got it. I got it before I read manga, or at least before this part registered as being like, you know, that early English manga translation. So it was just a standout comic, a one-off that's easy to read, easy to get into, a complete satisfying story, looks different than everything else. The appeal is obvious to me, and I think it holds up very well 40 years later.
Yeah, you mentioned Scott McCloud, but with the heaviness of this material and this sort of historic nature of it, Spiegelman comes to mind, and he wrote introduction for the first couple of volumes of the translated edition, and that seems very appropriate.
I didn't realize that he was the intro guy. There was a lot of things in this that reminded me of Mouse.
Yeah.
You know, searching for food, starving, you know, the oppression in this comic is palpable and really did remind me of some of Spiegelman's work.
Yeah. Now, this is a comic that is being translated into English. It's kind of like a very early foray into, you know, Japanese comics for us. So you got to kind of make it look like an American comic, which is to say, better be color separations on every page, which, you know, they seem to nail. It is a comic book, you know, a little thicker than your average comic, but it's something that you know, we would see and be able to understand here in the States rather than just putting out, like, you know, a big tome. Now, what I saw it is, this is actually pretty cool, too, where it was first disseminated was in Shonen Jump, you know, Shonen Jump. September 1972, you know, there would be one-shots that cartoonists would endeavor to create, get a response. You might get a series afterward. Not necessarily of the same subject matter, but in this case, that's kind of how it played out for Nakazawa here. What I saw it is, essentially, it was a very, very truncated, like you said, 48-page version or so, 64-page version of Barefoot Gen, of which there are 10 volumes of this thing, and we're talking 10, you know, 150, 200 page books, man, a couple thousand pages of story. This is the truncated, this is the almost like the notes for himself, the blueprint, so that he could like lay out his bigger story.
We often talk about the origins of, you know, what we call a masterpiece. Barefoot Gen obviously qualifies for that. And this is that origin. This is sort of like the prototype. This is organizing these ideas. And then, you know, at some point in that intro, it says his editor suggested that he expand on this story. But you don't always know what's going to come out. You know, whenever he sat down and did I Saw It, it feels like it's a complete story, moving on to the next thing. And in hindsight, or once you have this, then it becomes obvious that, you know, that's a pretty rich subject. Maybe you dive a little bit deeper into it. But it's cool to have this as another example of, like, how do these great works get made? It's one step at a time. You know, it's not that you sit down and go, I'm going to do 10 volumes, thousands of pages. You sit down and make this story and then realize what you have there.
I was reading watching some interviews with novelists, and they said that basically, like, you're not writing a book. You're sitting down and you're writing a couple thousand words a day. You create a situation, a routine for yourself, and you repeat that day 700, 800 times,
right,
and you have a book in the end. Also seems super appropriate given the sort of difference between American comics culture, Japanese comics culture. We did that Mouse edition, that Mouse episode for Volume 1, and there was a proto strip that Spiegelman did. Perfectly American, that it's like a 4-page strip, and that Nakazawa did a 40-page strip.
Yeah, right.
As like, this is my test, man. Just knowing how, you know, Japanese comics are put out there, man. You know, 20 pages a week, something like this. It's a big undertaking. And
what a compelling story. You know, the guy, the kid, is in Hiroshima. He's a young boy whenever the bomb is dropped. And then to go on to become a manga artist, like, it's just... It's so obvious that, like, you've got to do a story about
this. There's no choice. Like if you grow up and you go to school with Jeffrey Dahmer, there's a certain comic that only you are ever going to be able to create. I don't know any other cartoonist that went through what Nakazawa went through. His destiny was foretold, man. And look at just, like, these levels of detail. Like, this is nonverbal stuff. They're not talking about this, but if you read the history, like, you know that they would have to put these, like, blinds on their lamps so that they didn't send a fucking beacon up to the Enola Gay hanging above right. their head about to drop some shit on them.
Yeah, they give such good context for that, too. They talk about how, like, the bombing raids are almost daily now. Really harrowing. He does a good job of painting a portrait of what life was like before the bomb, you know, where his family was going to shelters during the day, food was short. You know, his family's struggling. It's one of the main themes throughout this whole story is his mother's struggles to provide for him both before and after, you know, after most of his family is wiped out.
So his pops had some art chops, and isn't this, like, one of the most beautiful...
It's really great.
...fucking illustrations you've ever seen? And, like, don't you wish you could draw like that?
It's amazing. It's so simple and perfect and well represented in a comic. All of that stuff, he makes it look easy, and believe me, that is not easy, what he's pulling off in those panels.
Mm-mm. Not at all, man. Family is established. Rich family, like, there, you know, there's a couple of siblings, mother, father, very loving house. You know that ain't gonna be for long, man.
Yeah, even showing, like, the older brother, what he's doing, you know, he's working for the war effort, while everybody else is just scrounging and scraping and looking for food. Even the kids looking for food.
Yeah, everybody's got to do their part. And, oh man, if this was a fictional story, like, it would, like, all the sort of stuff that's built in there is that perfect idea of, like, adding more and more and more stakes, because the mother is also pregnant, you know? Like, let's just add more and more complication to their lives, why don't we?
Yeah, it's a great rule if you are writing fiction is what you can and can't get away with, you know, because that would be a choice I would never make if I were writing fiction to add that extra element on there,
right.
But it does raise the stakes.
He lived it, man. And here we go. This is his first effort, his first attempt drawing that atomic bomb explosion. And the kid is so lucky. Keiji Nakazawa. And by the way, like, this guy, he got to live to a very ripe old age. He may or may not still be around. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. But, I feel like,
but what I'm saying, yeah, we could easily Googleable. But what I'm saying is this motherfucker was in the line of sight for a bomb, like an atomic bomb. He's seen all kinds of, like, people with their skin melting off and stuff. And the people who came to Hiroshima to help the people died of cancers and very painful, you know, sicknesses from the radiation. And he just got a bald spot.
This is an incredible page, this whole piece. I feel like I've seen so much footage of atomic bombs being tested and things, you know, where you see the trees just being blown away or the houses being blown away. And he's kind of trying to represent all of this stuff visually. Pretty interesting. Even, like, this idea, like, I interpret this as almost like radiation, you know, like, how do you show those elements, you know, from a graphic standpoint? That's had to be traumatic, like, just trying to figure this out and thinking about this part.
Yeah, so this is the truncated version. Let's just skip ahead real quick and take a look at how it reads in the actual Barefoot Gen book. You know, the simple flash here.
You can see really keeping some of the ideas, some of the representation. I think those are shingles maybe or something flying off the square pieces that we see in both versions.
Yeah. Whew. We're going to have to do at least volume one of the bigger book at a certain point.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
So if you read the bigger book, you discover that the boy was behind a tree. And this bomb is so sensitive that he mentions that if you wore, like, a white shirt, you're lucky. You know, the shirt didn't absorb any of that light. But if you had a black shirt on, like, you're absorbing all of that heat. And, you know, look at what this kid is witnessing, man.
Yeah, it's a horror comic real quick.
And he's and you know he's being sensitive to it, man, because like this is scary, this is freaky, but you know what he saw was he's trying to come up with like a you know, more respectful idea or something of like what he saw, and it's in the color, you know. That's not in the color. Yeah. I mean, that's not in the original serialization, but that is so raw.
I see it like where you see the flesh coming off the fingers and there's still kind of like the ribbons of skin.
Yeah. And he sells it, man. He's like, you know, like these people were hunched over and they were almost like crawling, but it's the least painful way they could move. This panel means a lot to me, man, where he's just like, what happened? You know, like this, he's a little boy living his life. Something happens in the blink of an eye. It's Wizard of Oz or like, you know, like opens his eyes and everything is destroyed. Jesus.
Yeah. Hard to imagine. And then equally hard to imagine drawing something like that. It's a lot of groundbreaking stuff. I imagine from his point of view and from the reader's point of view of like representing this stuff visually, because it really is like the worst horrors, you know, and imagine in Japan, no less, like the worst horrors you could possibly try to depict, I assume.
Just running, like looking for his folks and steps on a severed arm.
That's bad. I thought this was interesting of the lady who's like a window exploded and she's all glass embedded in her, and but still walking and, you know, in shock.
And Mama's safe, man. Mama's safe, but she has bad news. Now in the Barefoot Gen comic, it's sold differently. Like you see these feet sticking out and you know that's like the one sister or whatever. It might be in volume 2, but in the Barefoot Gen comic you see, you know, when you do something like this, thoughts come into your mind, right? Like, I think I know a better way to sell this moment. And you know, salesmanship. Like, you don't get much selling necessarily from a couple of feet, but you draw everybody's face in there with your littlest brother, you know, halfway coming out. And just, like, look at that.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough to read this sequence, like, watching her family burn to death.
Yeah.
And nothing she can do to help. Oh, man.
Yeah, super tough. Harrowing stuff. If you just saw this image, you would just think it was from a Golden Age horror comic or something.
Yeah, you really would. It makes me curious, like, what this looks like in black and white. You know, I think the color probably softens it a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I do wonder what his Zipitone application is. It doesn't look like he uses much.
No.
And maybe in the 70s, there just wasn't that much. Like some of the early Shonen Jumps I have, it's a lot of line art.
Yeah, I wonder too, like how far along he was. You know, he talks in this book about working as an assistant while he's also producing his own work. You know, so that may be a reason for the lack of screen tones and stuff in there.
Just this level of detail that you just can't make up if you weren't there. Like the idea that, you know, if a corpse burns long enough, it rears up like a squid on a grill, and it shows the body just like sitting up.
Yeah, you know, human bodies bake the same way fish do.
Right. What? Just walking down the street, seeing a guy, you know, who died just by getting pinned between, you know, a wall. All of this stuff, like, you know. He rode his bike past something like that, man.
Yeah, these kind of scenes of, like, the specific examples, you know, people in water tanks, stuff like that, has to be coming from memory. You know, like, it's one of those details that just feels observed. And then the smoke from the cremation fires, it's another one of those things that reminds me or calls back to Mouse for me.
Yeah. And these are the poor people who come to try to help out. And they all get fucked up, man. Can't help but think about like 9/11 first responders with that kind of imagery.
Yeah, very true. They're pulling out these skulls, something that I had not heard before, but as they are cremating these bodies, I guess the bones are remaining. And so, you know, I don't know if that's comforting at all, but it seemed like that would be something that many of them take or he's looking for. You know, later on, we're going to find his mother's fate whenever she's cremated and he doesn't understand why the skull is not available.
Yeah.
You know, you see, like, the pile of the bones from the cremated 2 meters high.
they have such little food that when the mother finally has the baby, mom just isn't getting enough nourishment to produce it. So of course, what they were able to feed the kid wasn't enough to keep the poor baby alive. So, you know, they have a little funeral pyre down at the beach.
Just horror on horror.
Yeah, it always escalates, man. It always escalates the entire time. And once again, this kid was around these bomb sites. We saw what happened to other people. He comes out of it with just a little bald spot and got to live a ripe old age. Like, is that luck? Like, the survivor's guilt has to be immense.
I love the portrait of his mother that he paints.
Yeah.
You know, she didn't have time to cry whenever her baby died mm-hmm. because she still had to worry about trying to feed them and keep them alive.
That's that real mother stuff, man. You ever get a real good injury when you were a kid and your mom no-sold it?
Yeah, it's a telling detail. I feel like it's something that's definitely relatable.
These people had no money, man. He's getting scrap paper, you know, butcher paper. This is Henry Darger shit, you know, like getting little scraps of paper to do some drawing.
This is awesome. This is like your early manga stuff, like the rental shops and things like that. We looked at Black Blizzard as one of those early mangas, and it feels like that's what he's describing here. And when he comes into contact with comics for the first time, a little callback to his interest in art that his dad made and that he was trying to make. And when he finds these comics, again, thing I can relate to, he's in.
Yeah.
And as you say, now drawn on scrap papers that he could find here and there. That's a fun story because the origin of comics, like whenever I first started reading about like Schuster and Siegel, it would be like drawn on calendars and stuff. You'd hear like those Depression era cartoonists that, you know, as kids, they would just draw on scrap paper because they couldn't afford pads of paper to just, what are you going to do, draw on it and then it's done, it's wasted. And it would just be drawn on whatever you could find, and kind of the same deal here.
There are these parts where, you know, he's going to school and he sort of hated going on like certain field trips and stuff because certain kids would have bento boxes of lunch and things. Maybe think about growing up in my district, we would have you'd have to have lunch tickets because kids would like beat each other up and like take your actual money. So you had to like give the homeroom teacher money at the beginning of the week, like on a Monday, and then you get your lunch tickets. And there were three levels of three different colors. So the kids whose parents could like afford it, you got to pay the full lunch. You get like the blue ticket. And when you seen those kids with the pink tickets, man, you knew what that meant. And it's like, why are you doing this to people?
It's so true.
Isn't there another way, you fucking dummies? Anyhow.
Stealing food. Mm-hmm. That's so funny. He's taking like salt on his way to school because he would steal cucumbers and cabbage and stuff, and then I guess sprinkle the salt on them.
Here are the kids that have the bento boxes, and like, doesn't that look so tasty? You know, he's like fetishizing like the food while he eats his 10 yen loaf of bread. Always working, man. Like that cartoonist POV shot, right? Like right behind the shoulder. We've seen that maybe 3 or 4 times up to this point as he just keeps grinding. His mom is finally getting a little more worse for the wear.
Yeah, it's taking a toll.
Yeah.
Worked as a sign painter before he got into the comics, which is kind of cool. You know, I always think design, sign lettering, all that stuff is useful for a cartoonist. So kind of neat to see that background detail.
This image, like working as the assistant, is fucking awesome to me, man. Because you see, like, the Japanese, like, the mangaka setup lacks all fucking pretense, man. Like, when you see American studios, man, like, you got the whole table that inclines, you got all this space, you got a million bookshelves and stuff. When we watch Man-Ben or whatever, they just have these, like, lap board things, and his looks like there's just, like, I don't know, a 3-ring binder underneath a piece of wood to keep it up, so it's not even, like, one of those, you know, tripod drafting board things that you see.
Yeah, it looks like a desk lamp. You know, we have the elaborate, nice round lamps and things.
Yeah. But look at this, dude. They do have the Chris Ware gimmicks, man.
Hang those pages up.
Yep. And now he's you know, finding love And one of the things that carries the story the rest of the way is he wants to bring his mother to Tokyo with him. You know, he wants to be a provider. He saw how much she sacrificed in her life, never remarried, always put the kids first. And now he's in a position where he can help out in a real way.
This is a beautiful sequence with the mother crying for the first time he ever saw her cry and has all of his magazines. And it's such a cool moment because you think of her as being so poor, not indulging in anything, but so happy and supportive of him, you know, from a distance. Never made it to Tokyo, but able to buy those magazines that his comics appear in, and so proud of that.
She told him, man, you need to get the heck out of here. Like, you need to go to Tokyo. Like, that's where all this stuff is happening. If you, you know, the American equivalent is like you had to go to NYC, print capital of the country, in order to like make those kinds of dreams happen. Ultimately, mom dies, man. And it's this bit that, you know, is probably might be a little specific to the Japanese idiom or something, but he's cursing mom. Mom, you fool. Why'd you do that? I was so close.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that is a translation issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trying to figure out how to express whatever was in there.
Or if it was legit, you know, like, why not be mad at...
That's true.
You know,
stage
your loved
of grief.
One. Sure. Absolutely. So now here's the thing that you alluded to earlier, Jimmy. It's time to cremate mom. And he remembers that the bodies that were cremated back in Hiroshima, you know, however many years ago, the bones would be left. And that is not the case for mom. She just turns to a damn powder. And he hypothesizes that something about that radiation, like, stuck with her, turned her bones into some kind of brittle substance. And even that, you know, is added insult to injury, because he thought he was going to have those bones to bury or something.
I think it's really interesting his kind of vow here of, you know, like that damn bomb and the murders, and he seems obsessed with, like, telling this story, bringing these people out, making them, you know, take some responsibility, exposing them for what they are. And this is one story in the beginning of his career in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And that's the outline of his career. You know, when he wrote those panels, I don't think his plan was, I'm going to do thousands of pages on this subject and I'm going to lecture on this subject. But that's what happened. And it's like, you look back, it's right here. This is the page. This is
right.
His Punisher origin, where he commits to this is what he's going to do with his life. It's wild. You know, it's like on a subconscious level, as a writer, he knew more about his life and what was to come than he probably did consciously.
Sure. Sure. And we got to have our page of like he's of an older generation now. Right. So we have to have like that frivolity of the youth and stuff, man, you know. Having excess food and confections, no doubt, man, and just throwing it on the ground. Like, I didn't like that, you know, seeing lovers live very casually, you know, kind of a hippie even.
Yeah, peacetime. Wish I could have been born then.
And then he's like, listen, I survived a fucking atomic bomb blast. I'm gonna start smoking. Ain't nothing gonna fuck me up.
And again, some context material, you know, like we're reading a comic that we've never seen anything like this at all in the early 80s. Tell us what we just read, dude.
Yeah, and like, let's look at these notable works, man. Suddenly One Day, you know, The Day of the A-Bomb, Okinawa, Life in Wartime and Post-War U.S. Occupied Okinawa. I saw it, the piece that we just read. Barefoot Gen or Gen, 1973-74. Drawing
that's
thousands
pretty wild.
Of pages.
That's pretty. I'm looking at 10 volumes here, all of them 5/8 of an inch thick.
Yeah,
and it's like that was
2 years.
Makes me real embarrassed about what I've done the last 2 years.
And just if you were curious, man, he did some stuff on pre-war Japan, the post-bomb generation. Like, so he looked at this, you know, colossal blunder catastrophe from many, many different angles, up to, you know, 78. Like, presumably at this point, his entire career. You know, who knows what happened after this? But he was still around, you know, like, you take a look and this is him, you know, what year is this volume? 2009, you know, lives with his wife in the suburbs of Tokyo, remains actively involved in the work of Project Gen, retired from cartooning. Amazing.
Incredible to think of what comes out of this story.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this was like I said, it was an iconic work, and, you know, he holds the distinction of being the first mangaka translated into English. How could this not be cartoonist kayfabe fodder, Jimmy?
Yeah, the only question is how it took us so long to get here, but there's so many good comics in so little time, but I am glad that we sat down with this one.
That's goddamn right, man, and there's some more reading to do. Kayfabers, like, follow, subscribe to the YouTube channel with the bell. We'll notify you when new vids are available. What you got, Jimmy?
Join me on patreon.com/JimRug, where you can see how I make comics like Street Angel, Deadly Squirrel Live. You can see my original art, scripts, layouts, the whole process for how I make the comics I make at patreon.com/JimRug.
Red Room Comics in the Wild, Murder on the Dark Web for fun and profit. Go get your hands on those comics. Every issue completely self-contained. Go to your local comic shop, scoop up the comics, or go to the Fantagraphics website. They have them available in limited quantities at this point because they're going fast. If you want to read them ahead of time before they hit paper, or if you just want to read them digitally, go to my Patreon, patreon.com/edpiskor. $3 for the archive there. More than 150 pages worth of comics, new strips every Tuesday.
Subscribe to the Cartoonist Kayfabe e-newsletter at the links below this video. You can also find Cartoonist Kayfabe t-shirts and merchandise at the links below this video.
Give them those marching orders so we can be on our way, Jimmy.
Read more comics.